handle the truth.
Should we or should we not follow the advice of the galactically stupid?
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe fuck yourself.
You're all a bunch of fucking assholes. You know why? You don't have the guts to be what you want to be. You need people like me. You need people like me so you can point your fucking fingers and say, that's the bad guy.
Clearly, don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Righteous Brick Podcast. I'm your host, J.L. Covan. This is 9:30 a.m. Eastern on May 31st in the year of our Lord, 2021, Memorial Day, where we honor fallen heroes who served our country like Ashley Babbitt. I am thinking about doing a Trump Memorial Day video today where their big reveal is that he honors Ashley Babbitt at the end of the video. Because it seems like that's probably the service member that MAGA country wants to honor the most. It's like she's a veteran, and they treat her like white people George Floyd, which is pretty incredible, considering that she was storming the Capitol with a mob that ended up killing several people. Anyway, happy Memorial Day, everybody. Not afraid of honoring our troops. Good stuff to talk about today. I'm gonna drop this episode early, just because you know you're off. Maybe you're at the beach. Maybe you're spitting on each other to celebrate moving past COVID. Whatever you're doing to celebrate this day, I have, as usual, a very busy day of lots of stuff. And where is time going? Where is life going? I don't know. It just feels like it's melting away, and part of that is probably my diet. Day one today, folks. Day one, take 592 of the JL Gets Back in Shape. But the good news is I now have a legitimate thing on my calendar that is giving me a goal, an ego-driven goal, which is recording my next album and also going to videotape it, going to start looking for people to professionally produce this thing. October 23rd in New York City. Ticket link should be out this week. As I always say, you guys are obviously good fans. You listen to me in my real voice. I would just say make sure you are subscribed to my newsletter at the bottom of the homepage of my website, jlcomedy.com. Just throw your email in there because the first dibs on the tickets, two shows on Saturday, October 23rd, will go to the newsletter subscribers. And it's also the best way to avoid missing things via social media algorithms. So since I'm going to be filming it and not just audio recording it, I think with about 5 months to go, there would be, as drastic as this may sound to some people, when you're 6'7", 300 pounds, and you should be 6'7", 238 pounds, 60 pounds is doable, but I'm going to just say, if I can, and I'm over 300 pounds, who am I kidding? My goal is to drop 60 pounds in the next 5 months, which with proper dieting, I could drop 30 pounds in the first month. And then you only have 4 months to drop another 30 pounds, which is doable. When you're an atrophied, pre-diabetic piece of shit, The pounds can melt off if you show some discipline. I know this from experience. So now that the ego of capturing my seventh album and potentially first special on video is really the motivation I need, because this will be, if it goes as well as I hope, this could be, you know, at least not, maybe not as big as the Trump videos were in 2020 for obvious reasons, but could be the biggest stand-up thing of my career. So can't have the McConnell chin by October. Can't have the McConnell chin. Can't have the Pompeo gut. Can't have the weak arms. We've got to get it all together. We've got to train like, you know, Rocky and Rocky IV. Just Drago and Rocky IV. Anything in Rocky IV other than Paulie is how we have to train over the next 5 months. So today is a good day. We will hit the gym today finally, and we will eat healthy. And then the Jazz play at 9:30. And if there's anything that gets me to eat unhealthy, it's late night stressful sporting events. We're 14 wins away from $18,000. It's going to be a very arduous, difficult, unlikely path. But goodness, wouldn't it be great if the Utah Jazz won the title this year? For me as a 34-year fan and me as somebody who stands to win $18,000 on a $500 preseason bet. Interesting. I had a couple of conversations this week regarding sort of touring and potential management. I talked to an old acquaintance. It's always weird. I'm always hesitant to talk about too many people in comedy as friends. I feel like the word friend has become very diminished in significance because we have lost many of our significant contacts and expanded our sort of surface pithy contacts, but this is somebody who I respect and got along with for many years. He was a club manager who retired, and I had lunch with him about putting together a possible tour, and he thinks the easiest way to do this, the best way he can help, is to put together like an extensive independent venue tour, because if you listen to this podcast, you know that I've had I would say baffling at best and borderline heartbreaking lack of success in terms of booking gigs and even getting clubs that I have longstanding relationships with to simply reply to my emails. And it's been very stressful. But he, you know, so I am, my goal now is to get out there and create the connection with all the fans that I have. Now, on top of that, you know, social media algorithms are not my friend. You know, last August, a typical post of mine could get 5,000 likes and be seen by 100,000 plus people at least. Now, a typical post of mine maybe gets seen by 20,000. Most of my followers don't see my content, which is why I keep trying to stress to sign up for my newsletter, because at least you won't miss the important stuff. But most people, it seems we've been cultivated to trust social media algorithms. They make life easy. They make your life lazy. You assume they're just delivering what you want. I've had fans who have written to me and been like, seen a post after 5 months and go, "You're back." And I'm like, "You're not listening. You're not paying attention. If you like my stuff, you need to, you can help each other out if you..." But anyway, I've complained to you guys many times about that, and it seems to, you know, basically be sort of a lost cause. But I said to this person over lunch, I said, "Yeah, I'm game for an independent venue tour. I'm game to go to 50 cities and play 100 to 150 seat venues, because there are people who will come out to see me." You know, like I said, I had 200 people come out to see me in the suburbs of DC at coffee shops and pubs because, you know, I did good work in 2020. So for me, I don't want to have to tell people like, "I'll be in Chicago in October 2023. Like, you know, I want to get out there now. My ego, of course, wants the clubs, and clubs make the infrastructure and the email lists of clubs make life easier. But if waiting for clubs is going to just make my fan base atrophy and move on, you know, not the diehards, but, you know, like at this point, I need to get out there and you know, things are opening up. So the faster I can get to your city, the better. So I'm hoping he can put together a shit ton of dates all over the East Coast. And also I told him anywhere, you know, Chicago and East would work for me. And also I told him if he could see about knowing that I have fans in these areas, like a Seattle, San Francisco, LA, San Diego kind of run. I don't know if this is going to happen, but that's what I've asked for. So I'm hoping by the fall, I will be hitting up a lot of cities and, you know, warming. Obviously, a lot of that I hope is able to be done before October 23rd. The more reps I can get for the and what was refreshing is this gentleman. I spoke to him about. I gave him the concept behind sort of the linchpin of my next special sort of album. And there's going to be a lot of material. Some of you have seen me on Zoom shows talking about COVID and stuff. My personal experience during COVID. And by the way, this is great. If there may be audio errors on this because my computer, which is 5 months old, is breaking down. So this is my second straight Dell computer. So I'm warning you in case there are errors on this episode, and hopefully while I'm talking now isn't one of those errors. This Dell, I'm done with Dell. I've been using them since college. So that's that's a couple of decades. And the last two Dell computers I've had basically broke down within the first year. This will be the third time I have to send a Dell computer back for repairs within 3 years, and it's the second computer, and it's 5 months old. So they're obviously making shitty products now, and maybe I'm sure some of you arrogant Mac people out there are going, I could have told you that. You should get it. Okay, you know, when I have 18 years or 17 years of fine experience with a PC company, I don't just immediately shift because I want to be cool. But yeah, I'm done with Dell. So in case there are any audio errors on this, there were audio errors on a Patreon episode I had to film, record for Making Podcast Great Again. So apologies if some of this is not coming through. Hopefully it all is. But I told him the main concept, which was sort of, as I think I've told you, the title, which I will only announce once we've filmed and packaged it, is going to be Half Blackface, which, as you can imagine, will touch on race and some my unique experience with potential cancel culture. And I told him, and he was laughing throughout, which was a good sign because he's sort of a cynical, tough nut to crack sometimes when it comes to comedy. And he was laughing throughout as I told him and explained the concept. But he also said, you're going to have to really thread the needle on this one. And I said, no, that's the point. I don't want to thread the needle. And I said to him something that I really meant. I said, if I can't do this the way I want to do it, like I'm going to do it. And if it doesn't sell, then so be it. I will be a lawyer, or I will write a book, or I will look into maybe find some other profession that fulfills me, but I can't do comedy. There's too many people who seem to do comedy. They love to talk about how honest and this is what comedy, but so many comedians sell out. And I'm talking about with their act. I'm talking about like, oh, I've found a market. I found a demo that works. I'm going to lean into that. It's like, why not lean into your voice instead of leaning into, and you know, people will say, oh, you leaned in on Trump. And I go, yeah, but I liked doing impressions. Like I wasn't doing something. Yes, a couple of times I was like, oh, this would be good. This could probably be a hit. But this all started from shit I was doing on my own. But there's a lot of quote unquote artists out there who seem to like really lean into what will work. What's going to hit? And I detest that. And I think, why do art? Why be an artist if you're going to try? And to me, this is one of those things. This isn't the same as comedians, as tough a business as it can be. You can't pride yourself on the freedom of speech and the rogue warrior of art that comedians love to pretend to be and then not embrace that, only embrace the label but not actually live it through your work. You know, I'm not talking like if an actor does a commercial, that's built in. And by the way, acting is much more fake than comedy, or at least it's supposed to be, and that's okay. it's there's a lot more that goes into acting than just your acting ability. But that's sort of almost a cliche at this point. But if you do a commercial, you're doing a commercial is like a comedian doing a corporate gig. It's not the same as like I made an album that I thought would sell because I went for these social media trigger points. Like a commercial is like a corporate gig. Like there's an acknowledgement that, oh, I've been hired to do a specific job. This isn't necessarily the height of my art, but this money will allow me to do more art. The way artists back in the day might get a commission or a sponsored by the Crown or something, you know, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about seeing people like I talked about this before with Sound Exchange, which is so valuable in terms of the money it gives to comedians. This is, if you don't know, like royalty payments from various streaming and satellite radio platforms. And it was a godsend to me that I never sold any of my rights away to any label, because there were years where that was the absolute bulk of my comedy earnings. And my instincts were correct. But I see a lot of people now will produce albums with like 35 tracks that are like a minute and a half long. And because that will increase plays. And I go, if that's what you do, if you're a joke teller, if you're Dave Attell, you can do that. But if you're starting to craft your comedy to meet the money, that's not a corporate gig. That's more selling out. If that's your natural way of doing comedy, that's okay, that you're not selling out. But I used on a previous episode, like the example of Gary Gulman, who does like masterful 8, 9, 10 minute bits on topics because he's so damn good. It would be disgusting to see him like try, and he doesn't have to. He has a career and he's a very successful, respected comedian. But like, if he all of a sudden was like, oh, my new album, instead of having 14 tracks, has 41, I'd be like, what in the, oh no. So what I said to this gentleman at lunch was, threading the needle is the entire point of what I'm doing with this bit. Talking about my own racial experience and my own experience doing comedy. And my career, my existence is trying to thread a needle. I don't need my comedy to also have to thread a needle. And that's sort of the point with what I'm doing with this kind of linchpin to this new spec. There will be racial stuff kind of woven throughout, but it's the real kind of final chunk that's going to be the stuff that if I get the right publicist and get some interest, that's going to be the real linchpin and the real promotional part, I think, of the quote unquote special. But you know, so I'm just excited to have somebody in my corner who can potentially get me work. It may not be the 5 shows on a weekend at an A-list club that I think I could do well in certain cities, but it's going to be work. And it's going to be fans, once again, hopefully propelling my success or failure. Because every dime I earned, basically, was a in 2020 from comedy, with the exception of sort of streaming royalties, was the work of fans watching my videos, buying my albums, buying cameos, becoming Patreon members of Making Podcasts Great Again, all that. That was all fan-driven. There was no comedy entertainment industry money at all, like literally zero. So I know that that can make a good life for me if I can make the connection and get the support from fans. So I'm hoping if and when I can come to your city, hey, you know, 100 seats in Milwaukee, you know, whatever, Milwaukee, 200 seats in Chicago, 150 seats in Philly, 200 seats in Atlanta, whatever it is, I hope to see many of you out there. I'm doing my best to get to where you're at. And like I've said before, nobody has contacted me with a city that I haven't tried to perform in, that I haven't reached out to. And the only real disappointment is, because I'm very calloused to disappointment in this industry, but the only disappointment is all those clubs that I have longstanding relationships with. It almost feels like, you know, to make an inappropriate analogy, it's like sharecropping. Like I was a feature for so long, and you're really good. We're happy to underpay you for a weekend of work where you're delivering A plus stuff, and even bringing some fans. And sometimes your CDs are outselling headliner CDs, mostly, to be honest. And but now I want to move up, and it's sort of like, oh, we don't want, like, we don't respect you at that level, even though you're bringing everything to the table that we normally would ask somebody who wants to headline to bring to the table: large social media numbers, great comedy, a relationship with the club. But that's not happening. So we're gonna try a mix of hopefully some club gigs and a lot of independent venues. And, you know, it may come down to a point where if I get a big enough tour, I have to make a decision about the future of my day job. And I am so scared and hesitant to leave it, because it is steady. It is there. It is dependable. It has benefits. And it's great to say this might be my last and best shot at making it as a stand-up comedian full-time and making a living and growing and getting bigger opportunities. But last best shot is something, but it also will not feel so great if a year from now I've fizzled out, which is possible. And it feels like it's already happening. And it's sort of unfortunate, because I'm far from a one-hit wonder, and I'm not even a one-impression guy. I'm a dozens of impressions. I'm going to put out my seventh hour of stand-up in an 18-year career. Anybody will tell you that's a very strong pace. That's a headliner pace for a guy who was forced for his entire career to be an MC and a feature. Yeah. Oh, and by the way, this Wednesday is my late uncle's birthday, and also, as I realized looking at the calendar, the 18th anniversary of me first setting a foot on stage at an open mic in at the Tacoma Station Tavern in Washington, D.C., 18 years this Wednesday. And had that show gone poorly, I might have not even pursued comedy, but it went good enough. They were a nice audience. It's a jazz club that had an open mic night. And I went, and my friend from law school, Hank Wilson, was there with his brother Charlie, which is odd because his brother, they have the last name Wilson, but spelled with, well, I don't need to tell you their info, but his brother looks just like the actor Patrick Wilson. Like, he looks like he could be the brother of Patrick Wilson, the actor from the Conjuring films, among many others. And I always laugh because I'm like, you got to get that sometimes. Like, your last name is the same last name as this actor that you look like. But anyway, they were in attendance for my very first open mic, and it went well enough. It felt good, and I thought, oh, well, I'm going to try this again. And I haven't stopped since. And it's been a painful and tough and still unfulfilling journey. But, you know, I went this long, and I feel like I'm ready. I've been ready for about 8 years by my calculations. I've been ready for 8 years to get a real shot. And this leads me to the negative news from this week. So that's the good news, is that I have at least somebody with some connections trying to work on my behalf, which is better than no one, which is what I've had for 18 years. But I also spoke to somebody who works at a major management company, and they rep some very... They rep some high-level people. They rep some people, without question, below me on the comedy chart. In terms of following, in terms of prestige, in terms of... But okay, so they definitely rep some people above me, and they rep some people at my level, and they rep some people below me. So that felt like when he reached out to me, this friend within the comedy world who works there, I thought, okay, please, by all means, please mention my name, see if there's any interest, or see if, and I said, almost as valuable as if there is no interest, maybe if you could give me some of that feedback on why there isn't interest. So I heard nothing for a few weeks, so I followed up this weekend, and the answer I got was good, because I finally got an answer, but disheartening, of course, because of what the answer was. Part of it was not looking to sign place. He said, if I had the power to sign, I would work with you. And I believe him, because he's been sort of a fan of mine for a while. But he said, I don't have the power to do that right now, but let's keep in touch. But he said, they're not looking to really sign any more comedians or performers right now. Though What's sad about that is I saw this guy who does these great videos. He's a Baltimore area comedian. I guess maybe he's in New York now. Scott Sice. Some of you may be very familiar with him from his TikTok videos, like from IKEA. Like, he used to work at IKEA. They are great. They're really funny. And like I said, I think on this podcast, but I said they show the sensibility of a real comedian. So I respect what he's done with the platform, because they're unique. They're very funny. They're very, very popular. You know, he's gone from whatever followers on TikTok to like 500,000 followers on TikTok. And I know that that has currency. I wish my following had the same level of currency over the last year, but whatever. But I noticed that I'd seen some tweet of his, so I liked it. And then I checked him out, and I saw that a new thing to his bio was that he's now repped by William Morris, which is, of course, the gold standard talent agency. And for some reason, that really bummed me out. Not because I was in any way not thinking he deserved it, because he seems like a funny guy. But I was just like, so people are scooping up talent still. People are looking to sign talent, just not me. And it's hard to not feel, one of the things I always work on with my therapist, and stems, I think, a little bit from my mother, is like the not wanting to take everything personally. Sometimes things are just bad luck. Sometimes it's not. But it feels so personal. So I was really mad more about that, not because of him, because I was like, good that like somebody who seems funny and like brings a good sensibility and has this good that he gets signed. Okay, happy for him. Not happy for me, though, because I can't get so much as a meeting with anybody after a year. And now it's becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy, where what I was told by this person at this management company was, they think you're very talented. They're not looking to sign any performers or comedians really right now anymore to their roster. They're looking for multi-hyphenated writers. Now, I'm not going to dive into that, because I don't want to sound like I fucking work for Compound Media or anything like that. But obviously, part of the hook of my special will be the idea that I am diverse on paper, diverse in my thoughts and in my act, not a diverse face. And I write lots of stuff. I have tons of sketches. I would love to be submitted or get the opportunity to submit as a writer for a sketch show or something. You know, this is now about building a career. And if I were a writer for a show, I could still pursue stand-up in my free time. And maybe I wouldn't feel like such a failure in comedy, because I would have a job in comedy that would also maybe boost my other offerings, or maybe not make me so dependent on the success or failure of stand-up. So, you know, that was disappointing. But then, of course, you had to get the line of, and they, although they think your Trump impression is great, they feel like it's not relevant anymore. And that hurts, not because it's not true. I'm fine with that. Even though, unfortunately, when I post a Trump video to YouTube or to Twitter, it still algorithmically blows up compared to all my other impressions. Even though, like, for instance, the Cuomo impression, as just an example, people fucking love the Cuomo impression. I just did a podcast with somebody on their podcast. I retweeted it yesterday. But it's me for a half hour as Andrew Cuomo. So, like, I got In Living Color SNL impression roster and skills, except I can carry those things on for ad infinitum. But it's now like, this is what I feared, and why, if you look back on my videos in 2020, my first impression beyond Trump, as soon as that first Trump video hit, because I'm not a fucking idiot, I thought, shit, okay, it's time to start incorporating other impressions. So by June 1st, that first video went up the first big one that got me noticed was March 24th. Between March 24th and June 1st, I believe I added Mike Pence, JB Smoove, The Rock, Andrew Cuomo, and I'm trying to think if there were any others. But I was already trying to mix in a strong handful of relevant impressions as like co-stars. And obviously the Trump was the dominant one, but you try to – you try to leak in all these other impressions. And then, of course, trying to show, hey, by the way, go get my stand-up albums. Let's build this out. And I had various stand-up clips go from like 900 views to 25,000 views because obviously they were getting recommended other videos by me. And so I felt like I was doing everything I could without the assistance of management or a publicist to self-promote everything that I could do, not just Trump, because I knew, okay, the Trump is going to be the thing that I now have to get out from under. So I've been doing the work for a year to not make that my only thing, except for the fact that the algorithms on social media don't share that stuff nearly as much. So a lot of people aren't seeing it. But it's very disappointing when a management company, when you're like trying to pitch yourself as a writer, sketch performer, multi-layered impressionist, and veteran stand-up comedian, that they still come away with the assumption that your Trump is not going to be relevant. It's like, I know, but like, how do you tell somebody, like, if they're not willing to listen or read or watch your stuff? Well, I mean, if you're not willing to do 5 minutes of due diligence on a potential client, then I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. Like, it's the same thing as like, I'm sending emails to clubs that I've worked with, but if they don't read my emails, then I have nowhere to go. There's like, my career hinges on, if I'm being pitched to your agency, could you watch 10 minutes and read a 2-paragraph email so that you get a gist of all that I can do? And if I'm trying to get work at your club, I need you to read my email so that you know I'm looking for work at your club. If those things don't happen, I'm in no better position than I was a year and a half ago, just sitting going, I hope somebody reads my email because I'm a nobody. And now it's like, I'm a somebody, but if a tree falls in the woods and nobody replies to its emails, does it have a career? Mixed metaphor, mixed race metaphor. How about that? There's your title for the episode. Just kidding. So that was very discouraging, though I still felt good to at least get an answer. But it's like, my instincts have been correct from day one, which is try not to be defined by Trump. But if that's all people watch, and if that's all people see through social media algorithms, and if an agency only looks at you as the Trump guy, and by the way, every other Trump impersonator has high-level representation. So once again, hard not to feel like it's a little personal when one guy has like a major voice talent, a guy. Another guy has real representation because he's an actor. Another guy, I think, is an actor. But none of this deterred other performers. Like, somehow people could see through them that they had other talents worth signing. But for some reason, me, I'm a fucking casino buffet of content. But, you know, I don't know. Nobody wants it. So the good news is, I hope if I can book a bunch of dates, that will at least, I'll be out there doing what I want to do. And hopefully you guys can come and see some good comedy as I prepare for this special in October. Like I said, sign up for that newsletter. Ticket links should be going out this week. So that was this week's depressing comedy talk. But hashtag real talk. This is why you stick with me, I think, so you get an inside perspective. But, you know, I said to him at lunch, I have no interest in threading the needle. That's the whole point of what I'm putting together, is not to be some I'm telling my story. That's the thing. I am telling my story. This isn't a made-up thing for clout to hit on social media algorithms. I'm telling my story. If I cannot be free to tell my story and be funny about it, then fuck comedy. Fuck the fake bullshit world of comedy that is so developing, which is on the left, it's people playing to whatever agencies and white guilt are in the fucking media, playing to that on one side. I'm not saying entirely. I'm just saying if you were to go the easy route, that's one side. And the other side is to be offensive and bitch and whine about cancel culture and PC. And in the middle is a narrow space where people still do jokes and comedy. And it's okay if you're an established brand or comedian, you know, people know you, you have a following, you have representation. But I refuse to try and be, I have been me, I have done my comedy for 18 years. Maybe it hasn't served me well, but I still ended up in a successful place last year and I'm having some success this year. But this is my story. So when he said to me, I understood what he meant. It's like we're in a very sensitive time. And I go, yeah, that's partly the point of what I'm doing. I'm telling my story as a biracial white-looking dude. I'm going to tell my story. And if my personal story that exists and is real is not fitting into the box that we need to fit in, then fuck comedy. I go out on this one then. It's a high risk, high reward, I think. But it's also, I'm not doing it for the risk. And I'm not even really doing it for the reward. I'm doing it because I'm a comedian and I have trusted my instincts and I've made really good shit for many, many years. Okay? Most of your favorite, you know, I've outpaced most of your favorite fucking comedians. Okay? And I'm talking the big ones. Because I'm really good at this. I didn't play games to get somewhere. And maybe that's why I'm not somewhere. But you know what? If and when I have to quit this shit after 18 or 20 years, or maybe I don't have to quit it, I'm going to say I did, you know, not to sound like fucking Frank Sinatra, but I did it my way. And that's what comedians always pretend they're doing. Oh, I just go out there. But most of them aren't. Most of them are frauds. Most of them are, as I call them, ugly actors. They play the fake game of Hollywood, but then they want to be like real and authentic and shield themselves with the brand of comedy. Fuck that. My entire career has been real and has been me, and I think has produced good things if it hasn't always been a financial success. And there's no earthly reason to change that now. There has been, every success I've had has been me and fans. So why would I try to change that now? I think I joked to somebody that I'm like, am I the comedy Moses? Like I'm gonna get close to the promised land, but I won't be able to enter. Then so be it. So be it. That's really how I feel. Because I've spent my whole adult life committed to doing comedy the way that I believed and quote unquote grew up thinking was the right way to do it. The way you're supposed to do it. If people don't want to sign that or don't want to manage that or don't want to buy this special, then I put it out. I'll sell like an album and a video download for people, and my fans can get it, and I think they'll be very pleased. But it's not being real for real sake. It's being real because it's my story. It's my jokes. It's my lived experience in this very kind of one-of-one voice within comedy. And that's, fuck it, right? That's, if after 18 years I have to not be me to sell something, then fuck the whole business. And I'm okay saying that. And, you know, it may not work anyway, but if it doesn't work and I did it authentic to me and to how I've pursued my entire career, then I go, good, I did it, like, fuck it. I walk away with my head held high. But if I change and get success, or if I sugarcoat or try to spoon feed people the way they want their diversity stories fed so they can clap and go powerful, fuck that. Gross. Fucking gross to do that. So I look forward to October 23rd. This ain't going to be some Nanette farewell where I fucking cry on stage. No, you're going to be laughing from start to finish. But there might be some things that make people uncomfortable. Well, so be it. Because I'm not doing it for that reason. It's, if you're uncomfortable, then imagine walking the fucking tightrope that an Italian-looking half-black dude has had to walk. And then have to see, even when the industry is pandering to diversity, to see your diversity and your voice and your story disregarded because you don't fit the narrative of a hyphenated person. So that's the energy that I'm bringing to this, but don't worry. That's the energy behind the stage, but that's not the jokes. That's not the material. But now, you know, hopefully you're hyped up now for it. And it's, you know, what inspires me, to be honest, I remember I believe Mario Joyner is a longtime opener for Chris Rock. Chris Rock, of course, my all-time favorite stand-up comedian, and my all-time favorite special is Bring the Pain. Other than, of course, Keep My Enemies Closer. No, I would even rank Bring the Pain ahead of Keep My Enemies Closer. But Bring the Pain, I remember seeing, I still remember this, and it was probably early in my comedy career. Mario Joyner talking about Chris Rock's bit, Niggas versus Black People. And Mario Joyner was talking about him. I believe it was Mario Joyner. I think that's his opener, if I'm not mistaken. I definitely saw him open for him once on a show, the Kill the Messenger tour. But he had said, yeah, that bit killed in D.C., and Chris worked it out. But that bit didn't always kill. And that's so that I lean on that because I'm going to have to work this bit out. In crowds that may not be down with laughing with me. And that's okay. Over my career, I've seen people like basically go to open mics and like run their like best minutes and try to crush. And I'm like, what good is that? What good is that to be like, oh, I don't want to suck. Oh, or else some open mic people will think you suck. Like that's just one other level of, you know, lacking courage that I see in comedy. But to know that Chris Rock, I mean, it's a different time now, but to know that Chris Rock wasn't always crushing with one of his greatest signature bits is not to use an overblown term, kind of empowering, you know, because you feel like, oh, wow, Chris Rock really went for it. And like he stuck with it and gave us a legendary bit because he fought through what are acceptable reactions. There's reasons and thoughts behind not liking that bit that are respectable and that make sense. But he trusted in his material and persevered, and a classic was born. And that's the ambition I have for Half Blackface. I never crafted this shit with the idea of like, this is going to be edgy and really bold and brave. No, I think it's going to be really funny and hopefully eye-opening. And I know the reason I have, there's bits on my new album. Like I've been trying to put out a little bit of the Marilyn Manson stuff. Cause I feel like there's some, like the Marilyn Manson bit is not like a unique bit to me, but it's really good. But it's also the kind of bit that some other comedians might touch on. So I'm nervous about that, holding off on that so long. So I may like put that bit out on YouTube just to be like, look, I'm planting a flag with this Marilyn Manson bit. But most of the album is singular to me, completely singular, which makes me feel very confident in it. Like, you know, so I'm looking forward to that. But anyway, on happier news, folks, went to the Willowbrook Mall in New Jersey this weekend. I went to see my first movie in a theater since January 2020 when I saw Little Women in the theater. And if you know me, what a horrible final movie for me to see. I mean, it was okay, but come on. And I didn't go to an AMC. I still haven't. Many people who listened to this podcast way back may know that my AMC policy was I will no longer go to AMC theaters because they were not paying their workers minimum. Like there were various bad business practices for their workers, overtime pay on holidays, things like that. And it turned out Regal Cinemas, like the main competitor, at least in New York, was doing those things, so I canceled my AMC membership and said, I'm just going to go to Regal theaters now. And then the pandemic hit, and I couldn't go see a movie anywhere. So I ended up going to a Cinemark theater. Don't know their business practices. I will do my due diligence. But I had a gift certificate there from December 2019. Still good. Doesn't expire. So we went, and we went to the Willowbrook Mall. And I will say, as I walked in, it felt great. We took the bus up there. And it felt great walking around. I would say 95% of patrons in the mall. And what really felt good, honestly, is that the mall was pretty fucking busy. You know, good to see people spending money, good to see people out. And what I did like, not, you know, to be a lib cuck mask pussy, 95% of people seemed to be were wearing masks and wearing them properly, by the way. And I thought, that's great. Now, I'm not in South Jersey. I'm sure down there they were spitting on each other and getting into fist fights while shaking glow sticks. But it felt good just to see people being socially responsible. And maybe that means some of them weren't vaccinated, but I think the mall still had a mask rule. So it was just good to see people not protesting. But then I found out before we went into the movie theater. So we went to P.F. Chang's. It was probably the worst P.F. Chang's experience I've ever had, but it still felt good. And I'll tell you why it was a bad one. I should never see yellow in my broccoli at a P.F. Chang's. Now, I've been to P.F. Chang's in Ohio. I've been to P.F. Chang's many times with my buddy Nick in California. It's sort of the two places I always go to lunch with him when I'm out there are P.F. Chang's. You know, just to soak up the local cuisine. No, I would go to P.F. Chang's and I'd go to Cheesecake Factory. Where I believe at the Pasadena Cheesecake Factory, I remember asking the manager there, the one-time manager, who was actually a big fan of mine because he was a Corolla listener, I said, who's the most famous person here? Is it me? And he goes, well, Terry Crews comes here pretty regularly with his family. I was like, okay, I'll take second place behind Terry Crews. Who's the strongest customer you have here, me? And he was like, no, Terry Crews as well. I was like, I'll take that. But P.F. Chang's in California, always green as fuck broccoli. The Jersey one, a lot of yellow spots. Now, when you drench it in P.F. Chang's, like, cholesterol sweet sauce for their beef and broccoli, you're just like, this tastes like broccoli because it's smothered in sauce. Never been to a P.F. Chang's that had smothered their beef and broccoli so much in the sauce to the point where you're like, I like the taste of the sauce, but I could do with 85% less sauce. Like, it's not a dipping sauce. It was at the point where it was like the sauce on the beef and broccoli was a dipping sauce. And I was like, that's kind of disgusting. But it still felt great to eat some P.F. Chang's. You know, I felt like that was honoring, to be honest. I felt like I was honoring letting China know let bygones be bygones by eating, traditional P.F. Chang's food. One thing that I felt was offensive, and I thought that I should tweet something and say, stop Asian hate. Was there was no joke. The music playing in the background, the Righteous Girlfriend picked it up. The music playing in the background was basically what I would describe as ancient Chinese trap. Like it had a trap beat, but it was like, like whatever that instrument is that you always hear, like, it was kind of like that, but more Karate Kid Part 2. I know that's Japan, but hear me out. It was like, are they really doing like an ancient Chinese trap beat? And in case anybody out there is like, oh, I want to hear that. That sounds fire. No, it was just goofy. But yes, had beef and broccoli. Then we walked around the mall for about an hour before the movie started. We went to see A Quiet Place 2. The movie theater popcorn was the saltiest popcorn I'd ever had. And I felt like this was very Jersey. It was like Jersey. We're like kind of like a civilized state, but we fucking oversauce our food. We have no class. We oversauce our food. We oversalt our popcorn. But I sat in the movie without my mask on because I'm fully vaccinated. The state no longer required masks indoors for vaccinated people. And we double checked to see if the theater policy, you know, you got to do multiple checks if you're going to be in compliance. And the theater had just announced that day that they were also saying masks were not required for fully vaccinated people. Now, my concern is, of course, and I get some blowback on this. My concern is for all the people who are not vaccinated, who decide they're not going to follow the rules because it's an honor system. But technically, the rule is, hey, if you're not vaccinated, you still need to wear a mask to protect yourself and protect others who aren't vaccinated. But I think people who would walk around with no mask right now and not vaccinated are the people who never really cared in the first place. And a lot of people were saying to me on social media, like, if you haven't gotten vaccinated by now, go fuck yourself. And I'm like, I guess, but you know what? I'm leaving room open for someone to be nervous. And if they have to work, if they work in a restaurant or a theater or something that's not high where they have to work and they're hesitant to get a vaccine, but they're following the rules, they're wearing their mask, they're keeping their distance as often as they can. I don't think those people should get the fucking death penalty if some asshole who just chooses not to get the vaccine and also chooses not to follow the rules because he can get away with it, he or she. I don't think the death penalty or grave illness should be the result of somebody being vaccine hesitant if they're also following the rules. because they're not vaccinated. So that's all. Like, that's what makes me nervous. I took the mental leap of just sitting there, enjoying a movie, eating popcorn, and not putting my mask back on because, according to the science, and according to the state, and according to the business, I did not have to. So I don't want to look like a jerk to other people, but the truth is, you got to get over that if you want to live your life. And I'm allowed to mostly live my life now without a mask. So that's nice. My church said yesterday, masks are no longer required. So next week, I'm going to be going to mass without a mask on. And then they can see that I don't know any of the songs or prayers. No, it's only partially true. I know the prayers. And I know my thoughts as well. But in between dinner and a movie, we just walked around the mall, and it really did feel good. Like, I remember when Starbucks opened back up last summer, and it was masked, and it was like you had to pre-order your order and just pick it up from a counter. But just going into the Starbucks where I used to read books and drink tea felt good. It was like the first thing where I was like, oh, I'm back someplace where I used to go before COVID. And being out in a crowded mall, it made me feel happy. It made me feel safe because almost everybody, I have the vaccine, but it also made me feel safe for the community because everybody was still adhering to the rules that were prescribed by the shopping mall. But it also just felt good to see businesses making money, like every business. The only business that seemed to be struggling, and I had to laugh at this, there's like an AR-15 simulator or something where it's just like, you go in and you could get like virtual target practice or something, or it's like, you know, I don't know what it is. It looks like kind of like, hey, let's go in here for $20. We can just fucking like fake shoot up targets and virtual things. And I was laughing because I'm sitting there. I'm like, it's two rifles pointed at targets. And the person sitting behind the counter in between the rifles, I kid you not, is just a small woman in full Muslim, like, religious Muslim attire. And I just, of course. And I said, hey, she's like, what? It's America. It's a bit, she's working at the store and it's perfectly okay. But I just think to myself in this mall, just a bunch of white Jersey people walking by and going, do you want to go shoot rifles with the Muslim lady? I don't know why that made me laugh. I like to project bigotry on other people. And it was the only business not doing well. So it sort of fit my narrative of people would walk by and be like, you want to take target practice with Al-Qaeda's wife? And anyway, businesses were doing well. We went into Bloomingdale's and I was talking to the Righteous GF about how I miss my favorite cologne. My uncle had bought me this cologne. That used to be like his gift, like a lot of holidays. He'd be like, hey, you're a young man, you need some good cologne. And one year he stumbled on one that he thought was a good scent called Polo Crest. If J.L. Covan has ever had an official scent, it was Polo Crest. Obviously it helped in my 20s and early 30s that I was built like a professional athlete. But that scent got me a lot of compliments, let's say, from the ladies. It was just the way this scent mixed with me, it was awesome. I'll leave it classy, but it was a potent fragrance on my skin, and I loved it. And it was the one cologne that I sort of wore like semi-regularly, like obviously when I was going out, but just sometimes I'd go to work. It was killer. And they discontinued it like, I don't know, like 10 years ago or some shit. And you were still able to get a couple bottles after that. But now it's been so long that I wouldn't trust. I would just assume that it was a knockoff if I was still getting a bottle today from some, which they do have them for sale on some sites. But I was looking up like what's similar. You know, some of these websites will list things that are similar to Polo Crest, and the reviews for Polo Crest were hilarious because everybody was just like, "It was the fucking greatest." Some guy was like, "It's a beautiful scent of manliness that you're not worthy of." Like just, but it was a great cologne. So I said, "Let me go look at the cologne counter. I'm feeling like looking for a cologne." So I was, you know, most of the Polo brands I don't like. I remember I had Polo Sport, which was, according to one of the websites, what Polo basically, like, Polo Crest was only meant to be like a limited edition, but it still lasted like almost 20 years because it had some strong, loyal customers. But Polo Sport, I remember my uncle telling me, he's like, I got you Polo Sport. I don't know, maybe you'll like it, you know, but it's a little soapy. And that's exactly what I thought. I was a little soapy scent. But it's endured. Polo Sport has endured far longer because it's just marketed as like, hey, bro, it's Polo Sport, bro. Whereas Polo Crest was for like, are you 28 but really want to feel like a 52-year-old senator with a mistress? Polo Crest. And that's the vibe I was going for, folks. Finally, a legitimate laugh for this episode. But that is exactly how I would describe Polo Crest. Are you 30, but you want to be the youngest CEO in your company's history and also banging side chicks? Polo Crest. No, first one was better. First tagline. We're going with the ad agent. The JL ad agency has decided the first tag was better. But so we go to the Polo counter, and I was like, well, I've never smelled Polo Red. So why don't I see what Polo Red is about? So we have to get a, you know, I'm like, oh, let me get a scent. So the woman at one counter is like, oh, just ask the woman in the blue. She'll help you. Now, the woman in the blue, how can I describe the woman in the blue? The woman in the blue was either Eastern European or light-skinned Brazilian, because the accent I couldn't really pick up through the mask. But she had big eyes. In the words of Al Pacino in Heat, a great ass. And no, it was definitely, I mean, I will say this. I've seen a lot of asses. This was, the reason I think I lean towards Brazilian is I have to believe either I saw the ninth wonder of the world or I saw a surgically enhanced ass. Because it was spectacular and sort of, but not in a way where if I leered at it, the righteous girlfriend would feel like I was being a pervert, but more like, I've always said this, like people stare at my height all the time, but if some woman has gigantic tits or a humongous ass, if I look at that, in a weird way, if I'm not sexualizing it, isn't that the same as just staring at my height? You're just kind of like, well, you don't see that every day. and I just kind of took a glance. And I was like, that's got to be enhanced or God bless you. And then she turns around. She's got these big eyes and like is rocking like a Madonna look from the 90s, meaning her shirt was like opened to the bottom of her bra. Her bra had like the push up. And I was just like, you're basic. Well, this is an interesting look. But she was masked up, so I respect it. And everything else you could see except her mouth. But she was very friendly. She was very friendly. And I thought like, I was like, okay, she was like, oh, you try this. And if you get this, you get like, they were doing, I wish I had liked Polo Red because they were doing like engraving the bottle for free, giving you like a nice travel bag for free. And I know they do that often, but I was just like, I feel like this is the time retail is like trying to boost their shit. So I was like, oh man, all I said to the righteous girlfriend, I said, if Polo Crest, my family was always one of these like, I don't need the aftershave body lotion, blah, blah. Just get me a bottle of this. If Polo Crest had like one of those Father's Day gift packs, I would have been like, I want all things Polo Crest. I want the body wash, the deodorant, the aftershave, the cologne, the toothpaste, you know, the Gold Bonds powder scented like Polo Crest, everything. I would have said everything Polo Crest. But RIP Polo Crest. But there's your podcast title. But this woman, she was very like friendly, like to give her credit. She was not like her body was selling. If you know, I joked with, I said that I felt like I was close to having a Clark Griswold Christmas Vacation moment with this woman, but she was very friendly and very bubbly. So she was selling sex, but like she wasn't doing the, yo, you'd smell great in this. You'd be so great. She was like, hey, if you like it, it's a good scent. If you like it, you get a bag and you get engraving. I was like, oh, that's nice. Thank you for not being seductive and making it awkward for me and the righteous girlfriend. So as we were walking away, she was like, oh, but she was very bubbly. She was nice. I was like, yeah, but you know what? She's either that way or she's a really good salesperson who knows you don't try to, I fuck the guy there with his significant other. Maybe if I was there by myself, she would have been like, if you get this bag, I will engrave it with my tongue. Like, she might have been going that route if I was by myself. And I respect that as well. I mean, because you've got to know your personnel, you know? Like, you get a scouting report. Hey, here's slightly overweight guy by himself looking for some polo. Give him the fuck me eyes and let him see the ass. Oh, here comes a guy with a significant other. Bubbly personality, best way to sell to this crew. Or maybe if, you know, another couple walks in, she's like, sleazy swingers from Tiger King. Give them both fuck eyes. I don't know. But I felt like the woman was seemed to be a good saleswoman. But and I would have bought it. I would have bought everything. I would have bought the engraved bottle if I had liked Polo Red. But as the Righteous Girlfriend said, she scented it on my wrist and said, this smells like something I would wear. And I was like, I know. It's like fruity. I don't. And excuse me. Fruity meaning smelling of fruits. Not fruity as in a derogatory term for LGBTQ people. Okay, thank you. But it was fun. It was just fun being out. It was fun getting to see a perfume saleswoman who looked like a Brazilian or Ukrainian porn star. It was fun walking around a store. It was pleasant seeing the people of New Jersey, at least in my general area, practicing rule following. I'm a stickler for safety and I'm a stickler for rules. So whichever your reason for wearing the mask, I appreciate it. Whether it was for safety and or following rules, that made me happy. For the community, it made me feel happy for the community, not for my own welfare. I'm safe, but it made me feel good. And by the way, I got a negative COVID test. My brother wanted me to get a COVID test because I've been doing a lot of traveling. I also, as I recounted earlier in my recap blog, I had put on another man's mask in Washington, D.C. By accident for 10 minutes. But he had also been vaccinated. And as it turns out, Moderna fought off all my travels. I am totally negative. So that's another confidence booster. It really fucking works. So the movie, A Quiet Place, two movie reviews. And if you are interested in supporting Making Podcasts Great Again, you can join that Patreon. Patreon.com/MPGA. But for those of you who are, you might have already heard my review of A Quiet Place 2. And for those who wish me dead, Quiet Place 2 is not as good as A Quiet Place 1. I enjoyed it. And I think part of it was just being eating a big bag of popcorn in a movie theater. But it was just more of the same. But because it's more of the same, it lacks the originality of the first one, which is sometimes what, you know, you want a sequel to bring new shit to life. And it just felt like, oh, this was like a good continuation of the story, but lacks the jolt and the punch of the first one, because the first one was all original. But good, still solid. And then Those Who Wish Me Dead on HBO Max, which is the Taylor Sheridan movie. Taylor Sheridan, disclaimer, I'm a big fan because I love Sicario. I own his first three, like, big script movies. Sicario, Hell or High Water, which was my number one movie of that year, and Wind River, also a great movie. I own all three. So I say this as a strong fan of Taylor Sheridan. But he wrote and directed this, and I have the same complaint for his, when he has, like, full authority over projects, that I have for Aaron Sorkin, because Aaron Sorkin movies that he writes are almost always awesome. Aaron Sorkin movies that he writes and directs, in the case of Molly's Game, I know a lot of people love that movie. I thought it was good, but too long. Because as I've said, if you're Aaron Sorkin and you're one of the premier screenwriters, maybe in Hollywood history, what are you going to edit out? Why would you cut anything from your movie? Like, you wrote it, so you believe in it. But, you know, when he does a movie like The Social Network with David Fincher, an elite talent in his realm, the compromise that comes out from the writing and the director ends up being an Oscar-worthy movie. So I feel like Aaron Sorkin, and then Trial of Chicago 7. Well, go to Chicago, protest Vietnam War. That's my impression of Sacha Baron Cohen in that movie. I thought it sucked. And I say that with respect because I'm such a huge fan of so much of Aaron Sorkin's work. I thought Chicago 7 stunk. And it was written and directed by Aaron Sorkin. And now we get to Taylor Sheridan. And the first blemish I felt on Taylor Sheridan's record was the show Yellowstone, which is a very popular show on Paramount with Kevin Costner. I gave it two seasons, like, because I gave it one season. At the end, I was like, okay, you know what? Sometimes a show gets its footing. There seems to be enough potential here. I'll give it to a second season. I hated the second season. It felt so much like he was such a man's man of a writer. And I don't mean that as an insult, but in terms of you write what you know, you write your voice, what works for you, that like some of the female characters were fucking ridiculous. You know, and I've said this before on the podcast, the main daughter character in Yellowstone is like, I drink, I suck dick, and I punch dudes in the face. Like, it seemed like a dumb guy's vision of the perfect woman. Like, I walk around naked with my perfect tits, but I'll also shoot you in the face while I'm giving a hand job. And it's like, what is this? What is this one? And I described a scene in season two, spoiler, where she is being, sorry for the, I'm only mentioning this because it's so absurd. She is being raped by like a guy who has been sent to like murder her and her like her brother or whatever. And she's like yelling at the guy while he's doing it. Like, that's all you got. And I'm like, I'm sorry. I don't care how tough you are. Is that an accurate depiction of sexual assault where you're owning the guy saying like, you're fucking pathetic. I've had bigger dicks and a blah, blah. And it's like, this guy just punched you repeatedly and is now raping you. And Taylor Sheridan thinks that your character is so badass that you're talking shit while being raped on your deathbed. Like, I'm sorry. That's when I had to check out of the show. I was like, I am done with this show. And there are people who are like, Yellowstone's awesome. And I'm like, Yellowstone is like for people who thought Sons of Anarchy was, I guess, not lowbrow enough, but pretending to be highbrow. And it's like Sheridan directed a lot of the episodes. So he had like, this was his total control, it seemed, of this show. And I did not like it. So then we get to Those Who Wish Me Dead. I think it was a terrible movie. And then I looked and it was directed, produced, and written by Taylor Sheridan. And I understand. You listen to this podcast, you understand the ego involved. I literally just spent a half hour saying, I'm not adjusting my comedy for what people say will work. So odd for me to say this, but I think comedy is a different thing. I'm not saying stand-up comedy is my lane. I'm not telling somebody that if I wrote a sitcom script that do not edit this, I am a genius stand-up comedian. No, because script writing would be a new area for me, and I would welcome experienced input in making my skills translate to a different medium. So in other words, comedy stand-up for me is what screenwriting is for Taylor Sheridan. Directing would be like me doing a sitcom. I would want other input and more expert opinion informing and helping my work translate. This movie was terrible. First, Righteous Girlfriend looked at me about 8 minutes in. There's like a real bro-y moment where Angelina Jolie, of course, is like the badass, like hot chick who's just like, who's more badass than the dudes. And I could feel Righteous Girlfriend just glance over me at one point, and I said, this is one of those bro-y moments that I hate in a movie that's trying to be authentic. People don't talk like this. People don't act like this. And the movie just goes in so many different directions, and it's only like 97 minutes. And I was like, that felt like 2 to 3 different movies. There's deaths that occur that you're like, wait, what? There's people who survive shit where you're like, wait, what? It was not good. And I hate saying that, but I was watching it going like, oh, I hope it's good. It's got a good cast, and it's got, it's Taylor Sheridan writing the movie. And I'm like, is he trying to write more like marketable stuff now? Because none of his early movies really made a killing at the box office. Sicario did pretty well, but was like a modest success. Hell or High Water almost bombed, but it did get like a ton of Oscar nominations, including Best Picture and Best Screenplay. And then Wind River was like a total indie failure, but was also a really great movie. So I don't know. Maybe he decided, okay, it's like I'm getting these Oscars, but now I want to make something that people will see. Like maybe it has to be more bro-y or dumber or more action-packed, which is unfortunate if that's his calculus, because he is a great writer. He's got 2 Oscar nominations from those first 3 movies for screenwriting. So he's obviously a guy who's earned his money and has talent. But between Yellowstone and Those Who Wish Me Dead, I was like, oof, hitting a little bit of a rough patch here. Now, I'm sure he's getting paid out the ass, and Yellowstone is very popular and well-reviewed, but I fucking hate Yellowstone, and I did not enjoy Those Who Wish Me Dead. So that was a full, robust episode of the pod, so thank you for listening. I hope you're having a good Memorial Day, or hope you have a good week. As a reminder, if you're anywhere near Hartford, because the Boston shows seem not likely to happen, I got jerked around by the venue in Boston. No joke. 4 different times they gave me like, oh, we can't do this, but we can do this. And I said, I'll take it. And then they write back to me like, oh, can't do it, but we can do this. And I go, I'll take it. And then they come back to me like 3 days later, like, actually, we're more comfortable going with this instead because we have a deal for our small room with so-and-so. I was like, okay, do you have any date with anything in this room for over the next 4 months? I don't care if it's a Sunday, a Monday, any date. They're like, well, we have this date, but there's somebody with a hold on it, but we find, and I go, well, then challenge that hold, and if they don't meet it, I'll take that date. Haven't heard back on that yet, but I've been getting supremely jerked around. So Boston will eventually be on the tour schedule. If it has to be indie venues that my guy is trying to book for me, so be it. I will be in Boston. I will hopefully be in dozens of cities around the country. But for now, Hartford, June 10th. Advanced sales matter also. This is not an invite for anybody to buy tickets that can't go to the show. That only helps me a little bit. I need people, you know, buying tickets and being there buying drinks for the club. If you're anywhere near Hartford, if you can make it, it's a big show for me. I've stressed that enough. But also, advanced ticket sales matter. Hashtag advanced ticket sales matter. Because they will probably fill the room with a few days to go with paper tickets. Now, that helps the club, but it doesn't help me in terms of my sales. Like, my sales, if I sell 28 tickets, I suck to the club. If I sell 80 tickets, that's pretty good, especially for an off night. Anything over 100 tickets is a fucking godsend. But once we get to, like, next Monday, Tuesday, and they're at, like, well, we've sold 43 tickets, they're going to start filling up the room with paper. And meaning those are tickets that are free that the club benefits from, because they're going to still be selling drinks and food to those people, but I don't benefit at all from. So if you're at all able to get friends, family, yourself tickets, please do so. It's a very important show for me. That's all I'll say about that, to quote Forrest Gump. And then obviously if you're in Long Island, June 18th, 19th, I am featuring for Roy Wood Jr. at Governor's in Levittown. So those are also big shows. Not as big for, you know, that there's just no crossover there. You're either one of 3 places: near Hartford, near Long Island, or somewhere else. And, so if you're near Long Island, please come to those shows. But the Hartford show is hugely important for me. So once again, can't stress it enough, but I hope you can get tickets to that, come out and enjoy that show, because sales for that show are just immensely important to me. So any help you can give is appreciated. But I do appreciate you listening to this show. If you haven't gotten vaccinated, please go get vaccinated. It works. I'm living proof that it works. I wore another man's mask for 10 minutes in Washington, D.C., probably the grossest thing you can do in COVID. I'm COVID negative and loving life and enjoying my freedom and my liberties under Sleepy Joe Biden. So have a great week. Hope you're enjoying your Memorial Day weekend. And I will see you next Tuesday.